Hi, so today's lecture is going to look at the materials from Chapter 9. We are going to talk about the choice between environmental policies and what is the criteria we use for them. So, choosing between policies or choosing between policy options. Options. We have a set of criteria that we like to look at when evaluating which policy we're going to want to use. So the first we want to look at is efficiency and then that goes hand in hand with cost effectiveness. The second we want to look at is whether the policy is fair. Third is what are the incentives. And fourth, is the policy enforceable? And finally, the fifth one is the issue of morality. Or we call ethics and values, social norms. Okay. So what makes a policy? So let's look at number one and we say cost effective. A policy is considered cost effective if, given the amount of money or resources, we max economic we max our environmental benefit or goal. Okay, so if we're going to allocate resources, what is going to have the most environmental improvements given the dollars spent? Or we have a given target for the environment, then what is going to give us the lowest cost? So if we're choosing between policies and we have a target level of environmental improvement or environmental standard we wish to maintain, which policy will give us that goal at the lowest cost? Related to cost effectiveness is also the notion of efficiency. Okay. And in economics, we've learned that if you are maximizing profit, then you must be maximizing where the marginal revenue equals the marginal cost, meaning you've exhausted all the additional benefits of one more unit. So efficiency is going to be where the marginal benefit equals the marginal cost of the policy, or in our case, where the marginal abatement cost equals the marginal damage. Now, we can look at cost effectiveness as the gap between total benefit, total cost. And we may have a policy that has quite a low cost, but if we are not being efficient, where marginal benefit equals marginal cost, then we are not truly maximizing the benefit. Okay. So let's consider a case where we set a policy that we have two firms and put their environment. First firm has the marginal abatement cost. We'll call MAC1. And the second firm has the marginal abatement cost. We'll call that MAC2. Okay, and I'll park that one right over here. And now let's just make that a little bigger down into the middle. So the government comes along and says we have a pollution target, and that pollution target we will set as this level right here. And from the unregulated emissions that we talked about, we have E bar, and firms 1 and 2 each must achieve E bar. Well, we can see that at E bar, that the marginal abatement cost for firm 1 is at A, and the marginal abatement cost for firm B2 is at B. Now, since they are not equal, we are not achieving the lowest cost. So consider the case where we go 1 unit on either side. So let's suppose we go over here and we have E bar minus 1. We go the same distance on the other side, E bar plus 1. Then from E bar plus 1, we go up. And E bar minus 1, and then from E bar plus 1, same thing. And let's get that in the right place. Okay. Now, if we were to say to firm 2, who has the higher marginal abatement cost, we're going to let firm 2 reduce or increase their emissions, lower their standard. So we're going to allow them go to A prime. So we're going to let firm 1 move this way. Well, what's going to happen is firm 1 is going to save this amount in abatement costs. Now, to offset that, we are going to say that if we're going to let firm 1 pollute one more unit, we're going to ask firm 1 to pollute one less unit. So they have to increase their abatement and move from B to B prime. Now, to increase their abatement by reducing their emissions, firm 2 is going to incur abatement costs, and the abatement costs in this case will be this box right here. So we'll call this box big A. That represents all of this. And this we'll call big B, and it represents this area. And we can see that the savings by firm 1 by being allowed to pollute one additional unit is greater than the costs incurred by firm 2, who had to pollute one less unit. Therefore, if firm 1 paid firm 2 to cover their costs, firm 1 would still save money. So a rule that says every firm has to be at E bar is an example where we are not being cost effective. Okay. So we can see, and this type of policy we refer to as command and control. Or standards. Okay. And sometimes also referred to as prescriptive. Okay. Now we'll come back to that one. So Now, besides looking at being efficient and cost effective, there are other criteria that are important in society. And the first one of these being that, are we being fair? Now, what does that mean in terms of our society? Well, fairness is a difficult concept to totally get our heads around sometimes. So, for example, if we talk about taxes, right? So, we can have option A, everyone pays $100, or B, everyone pays 10% of income. Okay. Now, one could say that asking everyone to throw $100 into the pool that's used to fund government programs is fair. Everybody paid the same. However, a poor person, $100 has a greater impact on their life than $100 of a rich person. And we'd refer to this kind of a policy as a form of regressive taxation. It hurts the poor more than it hurts the rich. So we go to option B, which says we'll ask everyone to contribute 10% of their income. Someone who's very poor, 10% of their income, maybe if they make $100, they pay $10. Someone makes $100,000, they pay $10,000. And they would argue that that's not fair. Okay. So in environmental policy, we often ask the question, who pays pollution? Okay. Now, we often like to say that the polluter should pay. And in fact, that is commonly what we do, but let's consider that for a moment. Okay, in many cases, so firms, they produce goods. Why? Consumers want them. So, the firm produces a good, the consumer gets the benefit. And when we talk about production and exchange, we frequently say that in the market, of course, we have our demand, we have our supply, and in equilibrium, market's clear and everybody gets the amount they want. And then we say the benefits of trade are divided up by producer surplus that goes to the producer. So that's his benefit from the exchange. And the consumer benefits from his consumer surplus, which is this triangle. So we have the consumer surplus, we have the producer surplus. And that's the benefit of this good being produced. Now, if this good causes environmental damage, both the producer and the consumer benefited from this exchange. So who should pay for this? Should it be the producer or should it be the consumer? Okay. Now, often we have found that we have produced goods and services where we did not even know, and sometimes till years later, that the good being produced had an environmental side effect. So it's, in this case, a situation where nobody on either side of the market could have known and could have predicted the damages, then they would, no way they could have incorporated them. Okay. Also, if we have the situation where if markets are competitive, then we know that in equilibrium, profits equals zero. And in that case, if we had a tax on pollution, that would imply then that profits would suddenly become less than zero. Then firms would exit. Therefore, the price would rise. Okay. Until new equilibrium is reached. So, in the end, who really pays? Right? So, the price rises because of the pollution tax. The price gets passed on to the consumer. And therefore, the consumer winds up paying by higher prices and lower consumer surplus. Okay. So, when we talk about fairness and allocating who should pay for pollution, it's not that easy. We all benefit from the goods being produced. However, we have chosen to use that the polluter should be the one who pays. And that is often driven more about measurement than it is about fairness. And that ties into the notion of enforceability. Okay. So measurement and enforceability tends to determine how we design our policies and is why firms who pollute pay. Now, it's easy to talk about making firms who pollute pay under the notion of fairness, but in fact, it actually comes down to measurement and enforceability. So imagine a policy where we said any person who buys a good from a firm who pollutes will be fined. Now, what does that imply? Well, in a perfect world, if everybody knew that they'd be fined if they bought a good from a firm that polluted, nobody would buy from that firm. That firm would be forced to stop polluting. However, that requires that every person knows this information. Every person is subject to the rule. The government has the ability to know when any person buys a good from a firm who pollutes. That is an incredibly difficult idea to enforce. So policy B, right? Fine. The firm. Now, both policies would actually produce the same result if we lived in a perfect world and we could cautiously enforce the rules. in the real world, it's much easier to target the firm than it is to target the consumers. Even though, as we said above, both consumers and firms benefit from the production and consumption of goods that have pollution as a byproduct. Okay. Now, when we're looking at policies, even within issues around enforceability, right, the design of the policy matters. Okay. So you often hear of fines equal to, say, $1 million. Now, that sounds like a lot, and it's a lot for you or I. I could never afford to pay $1 million fine. But what about a large firm? Well, $1 million could simply be a small amount of their operating cost. Second, firms approach the problem the following way. They look at the expected cost as being equal to the fine times the probability of getting caught. Okay. So if I have a fine that equals $1 million and the probability of getting caught is 1%, then the expected value or the expected cost is 0.01 times $1 million is equal to just $10,000. So firms carrying on say that if we pollute and get caught, we pay $1 million. For all the times we pollute, we get caught 1 out of 100 times. That means 99 out of 100 times we get away with it. And if by polluting we save $250,000, then over multiple periods, every once in a while we get caught. Well, it pays. This is an important concept when it comes to the design of policies, both can you catch people and how much of a punishment do you put on them? Okay. Now, the next issue we're going to talk about for is the moral issue. Okay. So there is what should the government do? Right? Now, do we want to see the government who very strictly enforces an extreme environmental policy? Does that align with our values? Do we want to see the government give subsidies to firms in order to encourage them to reduce their pollution? Do we want to see that people get fined and taxed for polluting? Now, every society has a different view of this and a different reaction to policies. And these change over time within different groups. How the people look at this now is probably very different than the way they looked at it 100 years ago. Okay. But that has to be taken into account. So quite often, politicians, this Well, choose. Policy that is voter friendly. Okay. So, for example, a tax on firms is something that many people say they should pay taxes on firms. Other part of the population will say taxes on firms is going to slow down the economy. They may say we need to have strict standards. Don't worry about the cost. Just tell firms to stop polluting and how much to stop polluting. Okay. That often appeals publicly, because it doesn't talk about dollars and cents as much as it says strictly don't pollute. It's bad for the environment. People go, that's the right thing to do. It takes the costs in a way off the table in the direct conversation and puts them as an indirect conversation. And this turns out to be a very popular approach. Then we see government offering subsidies to firms in order to get them to change the way they do business and become more environmentally friendly. This one tends to be quite unpopular because it looks like we're just giving government money to firms. People argue that once you start giving money, it gets built into the system and it will continue. Okay. Now, the other type of thing we see is the so-called marketable permits, right? And this is where we sell the right to pollute. Okay. Now, people will look at this and they will say that this, it used to be a lot of people thought, oh my God, they're selling the right to pollute. They're selling off the environment. Today, that has become something that has not received the same kind of negative reaction as we see this all the time. And you hear about it as called cap and trade. Right? And we will talk about that model in quite a bit of detail. Okay. So finally, we also want to look at the incentive to innovate. Okay. So does that policy encourage firms to develop new technology or processes? So if we put in an environmental policy and it does have the effect of reducing pollution under the current method, then is that technology or is that method going to cause firms to invest in research to find new ways to do it? Or are they just going to accept this and carry on, in which case we don't see any progress towards developing technologies and developing new and cleaner methods? Okay. So the policy options that we're going to talk about tend to be, I think the first one is decentralized. And these are policies that look at dealing with environmental problems through things like liability and property rights. Now, this means the use of courts. In a decentralized model, the government passes a law that says, for example, everybody's entitled to have a reasonable level of noise after 10 o'clock at night. So noise after 10 o'clock at night that goes over a certain decibel level is considered noise pollution. However, in order for noise pollution to be addressed, individuals would have to, say, go to court to argue that their neighbor violated their right to have a quiet evening. So the government does not go around and enforce or measure noise directly unless someone has gone and either filed a complaint through some arbitrator or regulatory board or through the courts. And in the courts, they will look at the problem and ask who has the right and who is liable. And liability laws are designed so that if I'm a firm that pollutes and I'm told by law I'm liable, then I know that if I pollute, I may be subject to being sued. And that idea is to get discourage me from polluting. Sorry. Now, it's called a decentralized policy because it puts it back in the hands of the individuals who are affected and to directly start the process. Okay. The second one is what we called earlier command and control. Okay, and this can be pollution standards, such as air quality, where we tell firms that they must produce in such a way that the air quality stays at a particular level, or it gets better, or we may actually target emissions. And emissions are what lead to deterioration of water and air quality and other environmental damages. Pollution is the direct end result. So we often look at these two hand in hand, but we tend to target emission standards. So this is where the government sets a cap on how much is polluted. And this can be either uniform, meaning same for everybody, or individual. Okay. Then we have what's called TBES, which is the technology based emission standards. Okay. And this involves imposing or requiring use of certain technology. Okay. Or the standard is set based on the technology currently used by firms. Sometimes it's referred to in terms of what's called grandfathering. We have seen these kinds of things when we've seen catalytic converters in cars. So the government requires that a catalytic converter, which is a type of filter, is installed in every car. We required the to use only unleaded gas in cars. So the original gas used to have a lot of lead in it. Then they passed a law that said gas can only be made unleaded. And before you go into the pumps, there would be a period of time where you'd have a leaded or unleaded pump. And that's now changed where you see regular, premium, and deluxe levels of gas based on the concentrations inside. Now, technology-based standards are used and they're very appealing because it looks very definitive. You must use this technology in order to protect the environment. Okay. Now, it leads to some very interesting incentive problems. Okay. Now, the next one is what we call incentive-based policies. Okay, and incentive-based policies are taxes, subsidies, and markets for permits, or sometimes referred to as EDP, which is transferable discharge permit. Okay. So, incentive-based policies are, as they are described, a system of rules that don't actually tell firms that they cannot pollute. What they're trying to do is give them an incentive not to pollute. So if a firm is taxed, then they have a choice. They can pay the tax or they can choose to reduce their emissions. So they're not told what their level of emissions are to be. They're just simply told if they pollute, they'll be taxed. And if the tax is high enough, then firms will reduce their emissions. And the idea being we raise the tax until we get the tax rate high enough to get the firms to reduce their emissions to the level we want. Subsidies work similar to taxes. And if it's designed properly, it's almost identical to taxes. As instead of being a tax is viewed as explicit cost, subsidies can be viewed as an opportunity cost. If I reduce my emissions, the government gives me money. If I don't reduce my emissions, I don't get the money. And that money I do not receive is a foregone opportunity. Therefore, firms will explore options of how to get the subsidy. Marketable permits allow us to set an aggregate target and then allow firms to trade amongst themselves to set up and get the most efficient allocation. So one of the assumptions is that firms tend to know their MACs better than the regulators. So when looking at how we regulate firms, one of the things that we have to look at, if we're going to try to be efficient, is identify the MAC and set our policy to get the MAC equal to marginal damages. However, that requires us to have a knowledge of the firm's MAC. And we know that firms have a better understanding of their own process than anyone else does. By putting in a marketable permit system, we're not worrying about each firm's MAC. We are just putting a total out there, and saying, okay, those that can get rid of emissions at a very low cost, they can take advantage of the market and say, we'll get rid of our emissions and sell our permits to firms that have difficulty getting rid of emissions. Okay. And this is a type of popular program. Then we have, finally, voluntary programs. And this is where government enters into agreements with large groups to achieve certain targets. And while the program may be voluntary, the strength of the program depends on the belief by the people involved that if they don't participate in a voluntary program, they may wind up being subject to one of the programs that we've talked about above. Okay. So that is basically an overview of the program of the different types of policies. So over the next few weeks, we're going to look at each policy in detail. So that will be chapters 10 to 13. Okay. So we'll look at decentralized policies next. We will look at pollution standards, taxes and subsidies, and finally, marketable permits. Okay. So at that point, I am going to stop us here.